Hello and welcome to the very first edition of Pivot to Asia. I'm John Harrison. And this program is all about what's happening in Asia, a part of the world that occupies at least 30% of the planet and over 50% if one includes the eastern part of Russia. Asia contains 60% of the world's population and has the highest growth rate today. In recent decades, Asia has been rapidly catching up with the West economically, and all of this has threatened the traditional Orientalist way of viewing Asia as some sort of backwater. Asia indeed plays a massive part in our new multipolar world, but sometimes you'd hardly know that by reading the mainstream international press. Now, our first program is about a new multi-billion dollar bridge from Sakhalin to Japan that has been proposed by Russia. An official announcement is expected very soon, and planning has been going on over the past 5 years. Joining me to talk about this project is Paul Goncharov, an American who's been working in financial services, mining and energy in Russia, as well as Japan, for over 40 years. Welcome to the program, Paul.
Thank you very much, John.
Now, this project it's very complex. It contains, I believe, a tunnel from the Russian part, eastern Russia, to the island of Sakhalin, and there's a major bridge from Sakhalin to Japan. It's a vast scheme. How likely it is to actually happen, in your opinion?
Eventually, it will. I guess you could put it on the same shelf as the bridge between across the Bering Strait. Mm-hmm. It makes economic sense. It makes political sense. It makes business sense. Perhaps more so in the shorter term is the bridge to Sakhalin and ultimately to Japan, because that melds very well with the whole concept of One Belt, One Road,
right?
Which is inclusive of course, China. And with this bridge tunnel concept, it binds a much tighter link with the Japanese markets.
Right. Now, you say it's going to be built eventually. I detect in your voice some hesitation here. You're not quite sure. You doubt that it's going to happen or what?
No, I don't doubt it will happen. Mm-hmm. The timing is everything.
Yeah, so it might be 5 years, it might be 10 years, it might be 25 years. It's not going to happen next year then.
No, I don't.
It's not like
so.
The Kerch Bridge project between Russia and Crimea, for example.
No. Okay. But I think the link inside Russia, link between Sakhalin and the mainland,
yeah,
that will happen, and that's already ticking. That's already happening.
Right. Okay. Now, it's a huge project for all the possible players, the construction companies, the development companies, the transportation companies. I mean, organizations like Russian Railways. This is a major project, isn't it? This is a huge new project involving thousands of kilometers of tracks.
Well, the RZD, or the Russian Railways, yeah, are no strangers to massive projects. I mean, look at the territory of Russia.
Yeah.
And they've been sharpening their expertise as well with the high-speed rail links, with China.
Mm.
Actually, well, the whole One Belt, One Road project is largely rail.
Mm. But the One Belt, One Road project is a Chinese, well, I wouldn't say it's a Chinese project, but it was being conceived, hasn't it, in the research institutes of Beijing and Shanghai.
But
and
execution,
it's been politically backed mostly by China. Not Russia. Mm-hmm. Russia seems to be joining in now, and we've got aspects of some countries which were part of the Soviet Union will become involved in Central Asia. But it's mostly a Chinese project. Now, how do you see that really fitting in with the Russian way of seeing the world?
Well, if you look at the planning that has been taking place within Russia itself, the planning also allows for the linkages from the Primorye Krai, Vladivostok,
yeah,
to Khabarovsk, and all the way along the border. Look, it may be one perspective is to look at it from the point of view of what happens in the Asian part of Russia.
Yeah.
There is one bridge for 3,500 kilometers over the Amur River.
Mm-hmm.
The second one is now being completed in the Blagoveshchensk area,
mm-hmm,
of Birobidzhan. But for how many decades, forever, they relied on the fact that you can cross the Amur with freight, mm-hmm, and trade over the ice with trucks.
Mm-hmm.
But a simple rail bridge for 3,500 kilometers was only one.
Mm-hmm.
So these are very apparent shortcomings that are being addressed now.
Politically, though, it's crucial, isn't it? Because this project would symbolize a willingness for the Japanese to cooperate with Russia. I mean, we are now at war with Japan still. Russia is still at war with Japan. Japan has not signed a peace treaty with Russia from the Second World War.
That is correct, because of the Kuril Island dispute. Well, you know, technically it's de jure and de facto. All of the Sogoshosha, the Japanese, well, the Mitsuis, Mitsubishis, Marubenis, Seitos, all of that, have been doing business here since the Soviet days.
Yeah.
So, you know, there is politics and then there's business.
Yeah.
So getting on with the business of life, I believe that Prime Minister Abe, when he's meeting with Putin, they're seeking to find a compromise.
Mm-hmm.
How that'll be packaged, who knows? I certainly can't foretell the future, but the Japanese are practical people. Russians are practical people. Both are pragmatic.
Mm-hmm.
So however one puts the icing on the cake, and it's difficult for Japan because, let's face it, even in this era of gradual de-dollarization, Japan is essentially a suburb of the USA. It's,
yeah.
As I said earlier, it's the aircraft carrier for the USA.
Yes, yeah. And it would be difficult to imagine, wouldn't it, the Japanese government and Japanese banks financing a project like this, which would really go in the fly in the face of American-US policy in the Pacific, which in some would say is kind of geared pretty much to isolate Russia. And Japan, here we have Japan considering facilitating the construction of a bridge and a tunnel directly linking Japan with Russia. It's an interesting situation.
It is, but it's also, look, you have got to go with the flow. History, we've seen over the centuries, various changes in alliances and preferences. And again, my preface is that Japanese are practical and pragmatic,
mm-hmm.
and they can read the writing on the wall. China and Russia are their neighbors. America's mm-hmm. over the pond, Pacific, not a very small lake. It's a very large body of water.
Yeah.
So one can project all sorts of possible scenarios, but it makes good business, political, and pragmatic sense to join the region and its neighboring opportunities.
Yeah, yeah. Now, if it happened, it's going to be, I think it's going to be a watershed mark. It's going to be the beginning of a major shift of allegiances, but it hasn't happened yet. We're waiting for an announcement from the Russian government. Paul, you're a man very active in business over the last 30 or 40 years, and you've indeed traveled to Japan, and I believe you were married to a Japanese for a while. You know Japanese culture.
For 13 years.
13 years, and you've witnessed all sorts of infrastructure in projects happening, of course, mostly carried out by the United States, because that was the time, you know, the Marshall Plan, the continuation of the Marshall Plan, and the Pacific Ocean version of the Marshall Plan, in all of those Asian countries. Now we see the U.S. almost being sidelined. Is this an ongoing trend or just something that's happening at the moment?
No, this has been an ongoing trend. This has been going on since the mid to late 70s.
Really? That long?
For sure. Yes, the post-war years and the huge investment by the United States into Japan was really to allow for Korea.
Yeah.
And the American involvement in Korea. And hence my term, the aircraft carrier.
Yeah,
And that required a very quick turnaround from the previous American attitude of the immediate post-war years and the whole war mentality to saying, aha, Japan now is like our best ally in the Pacific, so let's go forward. And it was a Marshall Plan on steroids. Yeah, okay. If you'll also recall, in the late 70s and the early 80s, the Great Japan Miracle, and a huge and incredibly efficient expansion of Japanese industry, trade, you name it, they did it.
Yeah.
And they were financing everything. I remember when they bought Rockefeller Center in the middle of Manhattan, and everyone was up in arms. How can we sell it to Japan, et cetera? Well, pragmatism and practicality. Right. They managed to renovate the thing, brought it up to 21st century standards, and resold it back to American investors when the real estate market dropped. So who's the winner, who's the loser? It's not a question of that. It's business.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, if it's just business, then we can, I suppose, start to look at the world in a different way, because it hasn't always been just business, has it? It's been business has seemed to be number two. Number one has been the political message, the propagation of a certain ideology and a way of thinking and seeing the world. And if we're coming into now, moving into a situation where it's just business, then we're moving into a new world.
Yeah, we are. And I think that there is a limit to the patience of people, of all the isms. This capitalism, communism, socialism, whatever the flavor of the month is politically, is more of a, interferes more with progress than engenders progress.
Yeah. Now, this project, would it be financed then by Russia and Japan jointly, or would it be under, you mentioned the One Belt, One Road project, does that mean that China would become involved as well? I can't see the International Monetary Fund or the World Bank somehow getting involved in this.
Well, not the World Bank, but there is the equivalent of the World Bank.
Yeah.
Now, within East Asia. No, I think it will be a collective financing, including Russia, including Japan, including China, including Korea, quite possibly. Now, and this is a game changer. With South Korea, it's in their interest as well. Mm-hmm. Not to mention North Korea, once this bugaboo situation, this frenzy, eventually goes away.
Yeah, well, talking about North Korea as being a country, a normal country, with whom one could eventually trade with, is quite revolutionary. In fact, you might not be let out of the building today. If that is the case, then this is a sign of a sort of a new consciousness forming within Asia, that we are a group of nations who can do things together. And this is something new, isn't it? And we don't really see this. Okay, we've had ASEAN. You know, we've got the cooperation agreement between the Southern Asian smaller countries. Mm-hmm. And we've got, I think, North-South dialogue going on between China and, you know, attempts to build bridges with Pakistan, literally bridges with Pakistan, and of course, a channel out to the Indian Ocean. But we've got left-right, I call it, horizontal between India and trying to build bridges with Australia and all the other countries in between. All these countries, they've got alliances with everybody at the same time.
Sure.
But this, a project like this, as far as I can work out, is quite unique, because we mean that Asian countries themselves will have to come together and to make this happen and part-finance it, co-finance it.
Well, getting back to practicality and pragmatism, they're neighbors.
Yeah.
When we're talking from an American point of view, that's really projected power economically and militarily from a very long distance.
Yeah.
And here we are. It's the neighborhood. And I mean that in every sense of the word. We're Russia, China, North Korea, South Korea, Japan, it's all on contiguous borders or close enough, you know, a ferry ride away.
Mm.
So it makes, long last, it makes some common sense to get down to the business table and do business.
Mm. Let's take a short break here.
Sure.
Hello and welcome back to Pivot to Asia. Today I'm joined by Paul Goncharov, an American who's been working in financial services and mining energy in Russia, as well as Japan, for over 40 years. And we're talking about a new multi-billion dollar project to link Russia to Japan through Sakhalin. Now, Paul, we had quite an interesting discussion already about the nature of this project, its implications on a geopolitical level. But let's talk now about some local issues. If this project goes through, could the islands of Sakhalin and also Hokkaido enjoy a boom in investments? Could that be the new place to go with your unit trust funds and your pension plan funds?
No, definitely. And don't forget the always questionable buggy bear, the Kuril Islands.
Yeah.
How that will resolve, I don't know. It's always been on the table between Russia and Japan. That's between Sakhalin and Hokkaido. And it'll probably anchor whatever bridge tunnel combination thereof will be. But there was even talk about a potential joint governance. How it'll play out, I don't know. It will be resolved. Of that, I have no doubt. And it'll be resolved in a workable, again, pragmatic manner.
Mm-hmm. You'll keep on using the word pragmatic. Now, what's in it for Russia?
Well,
because Russians are also pretty pragmatic people.
Yeah. Well, it does open up the trade channels with Japan, a number of two-way trade.
Mm-hmm.
Japan, of course, is a huge market for Russian energy, resources, materiel, ores, metals, you name it.
Mm.
Japan has an incredible technology base, systems and expertise base, and a product base, consumer goods. So it's a very promising channel.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, for Japan is also not such a shabby idea, because conceptually now you can get a rail link, once this situation is built, from Japan directly through Russia into Europe as well.
Mm.
Cheaper than ocean freight, even if the Northern Sea route opens.
Mm-hmm.
It's much more practical to put in sealed containers goods that'll go directly to your market as far away as London.
Right.
By rail.
And a lot faster as well.
And faster.
Yeah, that's the thing that we forget, I think, perhaps possibly because this program, a lot of programs produced by Sputnik are focused on Russia. But if you look at the global picture, you see that actually China is interested in creating an export route to the West through Russia.
Yes.
Now, Japan, I should imagine, is also interested in that. And of course, the transit countries on the way there will all benefit from this. Everybody will benefit from it.
Yeah. No, that's there's the pragmatic side.
Yeah.
And it's a win-win.
Mm-hmm.
Additionally, currencies. We mentioned earlier the de-dollarization trend. Look, it's not going to be tomorrow, and it may not be in the next 5 or 10 years.
Mm.
But the writing, again, is written on the wall. You know, it doesn't make much sense for any country to first convert their currency into dollars and then reconvert into whoever else's currency.
Right.
Or to keep it in dollars. Makes more sense, let's say, between Russia and China. Take my rubles, we'll exchange it to yuan.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or ringgits or whatever. You know, these are the sovereign rights of nations and their economies.
What kind of opposition do you see arising, or position that perhaps has already arisen against this project materializing, from other countries who have vested interests in it not appearing?
Well, look, you know, change is always painful for everyone. Yeah, there's sticks in the wheels, in the spokes of the wheels, mm-hmm. but... It has a certain rhythm and an inertia, I don't know, that is unstoppable. Again, timelines, it won't be tomorrow, but 5, 10 years from now, 15 years from now, I think that the role of the U.S. dollar...
Well, it'll take 5 years to build, at least.
Yeah, well, I believe that maybe not in my lifetime.
Really?
But the trend is very, very clear that we have to go to a multipolar world. Economically, politically, and geographically, we're linking.
Yeah, but it's very sad, isn't it, that here we are, we're talking about this situation, and this project actually could have been realized 10 or 15 years ago. Japan could have integrated itself with Russia 10 or 15 years ago, but it decided not to. Well, we decided not to. An agreement was not made. Kuril Island's issue was not really finally settled.
Well, you know, coulda, woulda, shoulda.
And now we have the new situation with China also being under sort of economic threat for some one reason or other by you know who, the elephant in the room, you know. And I guess we have a huge, completely new geopolitical situation where now, as you said at the beginning of the program, Japan has to make the decision, you know, who's it going to go with, you know, basically.
Well, you know, my background is essentially the markets.
Yeah.
And there's a saying and an understanding that you can predict all you want, you can model all you want, but the market does what it does when it does it. And no amount of calculation is really ever going to tell you where that inflection point and when it is. Same thing with programs. Yeah, 20 years ago would have been a great idea. But who was ready at that time? Certainly not Russia.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Russia was on its knees.
Mm-hmm.
It was absolutely killed with this whole perestroika, the collapse of the Soviet Union. So it wasn't the right time then. Not too long ago, there was artillery fire over the Amur River.
Right.
Between China and Russia. That was in the 70s. And only recently, only during the Putin administration, have all the border clarifications finally been settled between Russia and China. So we have to take a deep breath, sit back, take a look at the landscape. A lot has changed and moved forward, allowing now to seriously consider building these bridges.
Mm-hmm. In more ways than one.
Many more ways than one.
Yeah, and of course, people don't really want to build bridges, do they? I mean, there's a big problem with bridges.
It's threatening. It makes
it's
people uncomfortable. Yeah. It's change. What if? You know, what if?
Yeah.
But we're going to meet that what if, whichever way, so might as well do it bravely with open eyes and welcome it. And then deal with the fallout. That's better than imagining all sorts of dissonances.
Yeah. Do you think that there could be a real war around the North Korea or within North Korea to perhaps stop in its tracks this kind of pragmatic thinking setting in and persuading politicians to make reasonable political decisions?
Well, look, this is always possible. Look, throughout my life, since I was born, there was a Korean crisis. And yeah. I was born in the mid-50s. And you know, that was at the time of the Korean War. And ever since then, there's been a very high degree of tension along the DMZ, 38th parallel. Among some of the prognosticators throughout the world, geopolitically, is that that's the flashpoint. They said that in the 70s, they said that in the 80s, the 90s, and now we've got fresh one where we've taken it to another stage of tension.
Mm.
Yeah, anything's possible. It would be a huge setback and a tragedy, especially now. And this perhaps is very disturbing to some, that even like for this mini example of the Olympics, that South Korea is willing to talk and act together with North Korea, even to the point of saying, hey, let's sit down and see where we can finally put an end to this, to this noise and dust and nonsense. Who knows?
Yeah. Well, it's fascinating talking to you, Paul. I mean, we're looking at this situation, and I think you were saying that perhaps this bridge isn't going to be built this year or next year or even in the next few years. But the fact that we're even talking about these projects, the fact that planners are going out there with the equipment and surveying the land.
And a lot of engineering work has been done.
A lot of engineering work has already been done. And that costs money.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm sure that investment bankers are maybe listening to this program to to find out if they can glean any more information. Because this could be a real game changer, couldn't it? It really could be a real game changer. It would not only only bring Japan and Russia much closer together, but it would certainly, I think, go a long way to bring Russia and Asia together. And that's a huge step.
It is. And it would just confirm and make it long-term. Not a flash in the pan political populism move.
Yeah.
It's something that's a core development economically.
Yeah. Okay. Many, many thanks for coming on the program, Paul.
Well, thank you for
having me. I
hope
we'll see you again. Your expertise is very much appreciated. It's Paul Goncharov, an American who's been working in financial services, mining, and energy in Russia, as well as Japan, for over 40 years. And thank you very much, listeners, for listening and witnessing the very first Pivot to Asia program. Tuning in next week. Goodbye.
Sayonara.